This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Earlier this month, North Korea fired a ballistic missile. It appears that this was timed just as the Prime Minister of Japan was meeting with President Trump. The missile launch was seen as a message to test Trump's resolve to stand up to the unpredictable and dangerous North Korea. So how much of a threat is North Korea to the United States and to our allies who are its neighbors? Tomorrow, global experts will convene at St. Mary's University to explore questions about North Korea on the challenges and opportunities that it presents to us and across the world. We're joined by Bill Newcomb. He's an economist, and he served on the UN Security Council panel of experts on North Korea sanctions. Ambassador Tom Armbruster, he is the former ambassador to the Republic of the Marshall Islands. And Stephen Norbert, he is the Korean Society Senior Director and Columbia University Professor. Welcome to The Source, all of you guys. It's great to have you here. And our phone lines are open. If you got a question or a comment about North Korea and U.S. position with it, the number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You could also email us at thesource@tpr.org. So, Steve Norbert, let me start off with you, asking you about this missile test that happened as the Prime Minister of Japan was in the United States meeting with Donald Trump. What kind of message did that send?
Well, the North Koreans are clearly trying to send the message that, hey, we're here, we are not going away, and we're not going away quietly. The missile test is something that was ramped up, and the Obama administration had passed on the portfolio to the Trump administration saying, this is your number one security concern. And clearly, to this point, that seems to be the case. And we're concerned, too, about a follow-on nuclear test. There was a fourth and a fifth nuclear test since 2006, just this last year. So they tested twice in a year. They also conducted 24 ballistic missile tests. That's very worrying, and certainly it was meant to send a message to Trump and to Abe, and also to Xi Jinping in China, who had just had a phone call with President Trump the day prior. And that's of tremendous, tremendous concern.
What do we know about North Korea's nuclear and missile capacity?
Well, we know that they have a capacity right now of 20-some-odd weapons, but the real concern is how quickly they're proliferating. We imagine that they may be in the area of being capable to produce a new weapon every 6 to 8 weeks. Beyond that, it's the delivery capability, that they're developing long-range missile capability that could take that missile quite far, and that miniaturization technology would allow them to put a smaller warhead on that. So the rapidity has caused great alarm, especially in the course of the last 8 or 10 months, as intelligence estimates have indicated that this is foremost in terms of non-proliferation concerns, not just in Asia, but globally.
Bill Newcomb, we've seen that sanctions have been turned on North Korea repeatedly. Have they worked? And is there any more room for tightening?
Well, there's quite a bit more that could be done. But the most important step that could be taken in terms of sanctions is to get better enforcement from the UN member states. The UN panel of experts has a report that's due to be released in the next couple of weeks. It has been leaked, and according to the text that was leaked, they find that member states, by not enforcing the measures rigorously, have let North Korea's international network of suppliers and agents and acquisition just operate almost unimpeded. And that's why we're seeing the more rapid pace in development of the nuclear weapons. The missile launch that just took place was a game changer because that was solid fueled. And so it's very much a hard to pin down mobile target compared to the liquid fuel, which has to be on the pad for some time.
So it can be a mobile missile.
Mobile threat.
Yeah. And North Korea is not a big country. It's 25 million plus people, one-fifth the size of Texas. Ambassador, why is North Korea wield so much threat? How can a little country like that be such a big problem?
I think in security terms, if you look at U.S. capability and our military might and you compare it with North Korea, basically you're comparing a polar bear with a little kitten. This is not a global power, but it's a regional threat and it's a regional problem that has been unaddressed for a long time. It's a very repressive regime, and I think it's incumbent on the United States and China and other countries to accelerate any kind of change in a positive direction, because the North Koreans have been suffering for a long time under what as Bill was saying, is a very difficult life for most North Koreans.
What is the mission of North Korea? What are they trying to achieve? Why take on such a role that would actually cause the polar bear to reach out and swat the kitten?
I think that they've found that they can push the envelope and that bad behavior sometimes brings rewards. It brings them notoriety. But I think China may be miscalculating in not thinking and imagining what life would be like with a united Korea. You think of South Korea's very dynamic economy, really well-run government, and China could have on its doorstep a great trading partner. They choose to think of it as a buffer, but I think that's a miscalculation.
And so is that something that is actually on the table, Mr. Norbert?
Yeah, sure. So the biggest concern in terms of your question of the disproportionality, the asymmetric threat, is that North Korea lives in an earlier day. They live in a day where they run rampant in terms of their proliferation development. They live on a divided peninsula. It is our last vestige of the Cold War. And you have the most heavily militarized area of the world in terms of the placement of artillery, in terms of the massing of troops. That makes Korea a real flashpoint. And North Korea, unwieldy and unstable, is dangerous to us.
What about the biological weapons? That's the thing that kind of makes me the most concerned, because I know that they have stockpiles of smallpox, anthrax, and who knows what else they can cook up with advances in CRISPR technology. Is that really something that we really need to pay a lot of attention to that?
Well, we do. And interestingly enough, most of the focus has been on conventional forces. Most of the focus has been on the nuclear and missile threat. Little focus in recent years publicly has been paid to chemical and biological warfare. But the assassination of Kim Jong-nam, the half-brother of leader Kim Jong-un in Malaysia, has raised that specter. How does one get a hold of VX? Well, that's a government-controlled resource, and clearly that was part of North Korea's hit. So what they've inadvertently done now is turn the spotlight on themselves and draw international condemnation and concern about CBW.
And Mr. Newcomb?
Yeah, since 2006, the first UN Security Council resolution to sanction North Korea, the language reads, to prevent nuclear, ballistic missile, and other WMD. So that includes the biologicals and the chemicals, although, as Steve said, it doesn't get an awful lot of attention in the global press.
All right, we're going to take a break here. We'll get a couple of these callers on the air. John, you're going to be coming up next. Phone lines are open. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. We're talking about North Korea. They're having a sit-down conversation, symposium about that this tomorrow at St. Mary's University. We've got some experts here with us in the studio. Just as North Korea is making big news across the world, if you've got a question or comment, give us a call, 210-614-8980. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about challenges and opportunities for North Korea, the dictatorship, the communist country, the state sponsor of terrorism, is firing missiles, it's assassinating the half-brother of the ruler, using the chemical weapons. They're executing senior officials in all sorts of imaginative ways. Most recently, they used anti-aircraft weapons, but they've used dogs and flamethrowers in the past in order to execute prisoners. North Korea is a scary place, but what does it mean for the United States and the world? Is it really a threat? We ask you to call in. The number is 210-614-8980. John has called in. John, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you, and thank you for having such a great panel on. I worked in South Korea for about 5 years with WMD, threat reduction with DITRA. And everything that's going on, I think, is actually a little bit reassuring because it shows that Kim Jong-un is consolidating his power, and the Kim dynasty has really been his playbook. All the things we're seeing are actually more out of his grandfather's playbook than his father's. And I guess this pushes away the nightmare scenario that a lot of analysts have where the Kim dynasty might collapse. And then we worry about what fills in that vacuum. Is it going to be like Syria or Libya or these other places where we've seen strongmen go away? Might there be some type of military action that takes over? And as long as he's doing the things that we can have seen before and can somewhat predict and understand their motivations, it's a lot less threatening than some of the scenarios where the dynasty falls.
All right, John, thank you for the call. And let me ask you about that. Bill Newcomb, do you share that reassurance?
I think it's difficult to know whether he's acting to secure power or because he feels a threat. His father, Kim Jong-il, was able to manage the uncle that Kim Jong-un assassinated or had killed. So there's a little bit of debate about that, but I would think that most observers say that he's firmly in control. If you have a collapse scenario, you have an immediate problem with what's called loose nukes that has to be taken care of. You have a refugee situation. So I don't think anyone's looking for a collapse scenario to take place, and so that's probably good. But a managed reduction in the North Korean threat, that is exactly what the UN Security Council resolutions are meant to achieve, to find some kind of diplomatic solution to this threat to international peace and security, to get them back into the NPT, and to get them off of this missile development and nuclear development program.
And Steve Norper?
Yeah, well, John's exactly right in pointing out that you can see more of a pattern and that we should approach North Korea as a rational actor, as irrational as its actions seem to be. But it is all about regime survivability. It is about the Kim family trying to maintain its dynasty. And where it becomes a concern is when you have such tremendous threats on any number of fronts, and we've talked about nuclear, we've talked about missile, we've talked about chemical, biological, we've talked about conventional, and certainly there's a tremendous challenge in terms of human rights, where you have 80 to 120,000 North Koreans who live in a gulag-type reality in prison labor camps, and that has been really dealt with very thoroughly by the United Nations Commission of Inquiry, which released a report 3 years ago this week. So you're talking about one of the foremost human rights crises on this planet. And where it becomes a challenge is that the United States, China, Japan, and Russia, all great powers, have interests that converge only in one place, which is on the Korean Peninsula. And so there's potential for a lot of discord, especially if you take what Bill's just said about potential for loose nukes, refugee flows, if there's sudden collapse. On the one hand, he may be hardening his stance and his regime. On the other hand, when you purge as many people as he's purged, upwards of 140 individuals, you can't help but wonder if there are hot pockets of resistance that are growing or if there are real fractures. And as information flows into North Korea, perhaps a rise in terms of public awareness and public expectations. And the millennials, young North Koreans who didn't know the father or the grandfather, all of these create challenges for North Korea. And there are things that we need to be aware of and that we in the international community need to be prepared to exploit.
Back to the phone lines. Shaka is on the line. Shaka, welcome to we just lost the caller. But the caller indicated to the screener that he didn't think that the North Korea was that much of a threat to the United States, and probably it's overblown. Let me ask you about that, Ambassador Ambruster. Do you see North Korea as a serious threat that needs to be taken? Well, you know, as at face value, it's a nuclear power, right?
Right. And you saw General Mattis's first trip overseas was to South Korea, his Asia trip. And I think that signals that this alliance with South Korea is very important. And after the shakiness that we heard in the election about NATO and the U.S. commitment to NATO, I think that was a very important trip to make. As far as the actual nuclear threat, I think we want to live in a world where there's no nuclear testing. So I think with John, the caller, had talked about the status quo being reassuring. I think we want to try to move off of the status quo however we can. And on the suite of possible things the U.S. can do, you know, we had a very difficult relationship with Cuba, but eventually we established diplomatic relations. And I think with that, you can see what's happening on the ground. You can see what the economy's up to. You can get the mood of the people. So we use a carrot and stick approach, but it's the whole suite. It's using diplomatic power, and it's also using military power to get North Korea to change its behavior.
So this is happening. We're a little more than a month into a new president here in the United States, Donald Trump, and national security is one of his top issues. He'll be talking about tonight as he addresses the joint session of Congress. And he has signaled that he thinks that China has a lot more control over North Korea than others have given it credit for. There's some control, but how much control is there? So, Bill Newcomb, how big of a player is China when it comes to dealing with North Korea?
Well, it's their most important trading partner. They share a long border. A lot of North Korea's violations of sanctions take place through Chinese middlemen. They use Chinese ports to move cargo in and out of North Korea. So they're terribly important. China just sent a message to North Korea saying that they were not going to import any more coal this year, and that was North Korea's major export, and it was one of the targets of the most recent UN sanctions resolution. So North Korea was not pleased to hear that, and they actually challenged China for going along with the U.S. in imposing this particular embargo. So China, for years, though, has been coddling North Korea's behavior. And so that's the kind of policy that has to change. Sanctioned individuals that are known by the Chinese continue to operate in China. Sanctioned entities are known by the Chinese and continue to operate in China. So this kind of behavior on the Chinese part is giving North Korea license to continue business as usual. And that's what has to change. And can China solve the problem on its own? Absolutely not. But China can make life much more difficult, where North Korea could be more willing to come back into six-party talks.
But Donald Trump has said that China has the ability to disappear this guy, that to really just take out Kim in North Korea. So, Stephen Norper?
Yeah, no, that is an overstatement in the least. The relationship between China and North Korea is one that goes back decades and was born in the Korean War. But beyond that, there is no warm feeling in China-North Korea relations today. In fact, there's a great deal of complaints. If you speak with Chinese officials and scholars, they like to point out that North Korea is a burden to them, that they don't understand the decision-making, that they felt strongly about the grandfather, Kim Il-sung, less about the son, Kim Jong-il, and certainly not very well about Kim Jong-un. They don't like the unpredictability on the border. They don't like these missile enhancements, which actually put Chinese territory within range. They're concerned about refugee flows from North Korea. They're concerned about the pandemics that go with those refugee flows. And ultimately, they're concerned about an ethnic Korean minority in Northeast China and North Korea giving fuel to that. So there's a lot of difficulty in that relationship. North Koreans, too, aren't crazy about the Chinese. They want strategic diversity. It's one of the reasons they've turned to the Russians and others.
And Ambassador Embrister?
I just wanted to mention, pick up on the Russians. That's one country that is happy with the status quo. They get North Korean workers. I was consul general in Vladivostok 2007 to 2010 and saw many North Koreans working in seafood factories and the timber industry. And it's an interesting border. It's the range of the Amur leopard.
Some people say those workers are slave workers.
We tried to interview them. We had a couple asylum seekers that jumped over the fence at the South Korean consulate, and we try to glean what we can from them so we can put that in our human rights report. I don't think we saw gross violations in Russia. But I think what we heard was these were people living very desperate lives, and that the money they were making was not going back to their families. It was going back to North Korea. But I think Russia is very happy to see this complicated relationship for the United States, and that's a country that's not going to push in the right direction.
So how much control does Russia have over North Korea? Because they say that North Korea's form of communism is actually more similar to the old Soviet Union style. They share a lot of ideological similarities.
I think for the old Soviets, there's a real affinity for that. that type of communism. I think they remember it well. They have nostalgia for it. And they recognize it and understand it. So I think Russia is very comfortable with the situation. They don't like the nuclear testing. I have to say the people in the Russian Far East were not pleased when there were tests. But I think they're happy to have the workers. They do have some trade with them. And overall, they're very happy that the U.S. has a complication.
Yes, sir. If I can just follow on quickly with that, I think one of the things we should also be thinking about with Russia on a positive bent is if the relationship improves between Russia and the United States, is there an opportunity to get Russia to work with us, with the United States and with the international community to move North Korea in a healthier direction, to try to rein in their nuclear capability or to try to freeze that? But you're quite right to point out that the human rights issues, the gulag, are reminiscent of Stalin, and that there are very appropriate models and in terms of the way it's developed. I, though, would tend to say, let's see if there are areas that we can bring Russia to the table with the North Koreans and maybe make some progress. The North Koreans with whom I met last year, early last year in Kuala Lumpur, by all places, were quick to say, hey, we want to be regarded as the new Soviets. That was the term they used. And that's kind of a scary statement. I mean, clearly, as you've pointed out, it's a small country, but they feel they've matured to a point where they demand recognition. They don't want to be a Libya. They don't want to be in Iran. They want to be recognized and respected, but clearly their behavior doesn't warrant that.
And President Trump has also said that Iran is a close ally of North Korea and that there could be a button to push there to try to improve relations, that as we negotiate with Iran, that we should put some sort of conditions of North Korea in there as well. I mean, are you familiar with that at all? Go ahead.
Sure. Iran's mentioned in a couple of contexts, but maybe the most worrying one is in terms of the transfer of technology that took place by way of the development of nuclear capability in North Korea. And that now is, as Bill can tell us from his work with the United Nations, is very heavily monitored. The solution, too, though, in terms of the Iran nuclear agreement, is one that people have thrown out potentially for North Korea. Those who argue against it say, yes, but the problem is Iran was not a nuclear, as we've said here, power or has that nuclear weapons capability, whereas our conundrum is North Korea now does.
And having been able to deliver that as well, and did you want to follow up on that, Bill Newcomb?
Just a little bit. North Korea and Iran have signed a science and technological agreement. The only other country that North Korea signed one with was Syria. And in Syria, we saw the fruit of that particular agreement was building atomic reactor that the Israelis destroyed. So, you know, I'm very concerned about what the terms of this particular agreement might contain. Nobody knows. The terms itself have been kept quiet. So there is cooperation in the ballistic missile field. Whether or not nuclear cooperation continues to go on, there's speculation. There's no evidence. I mean, they use a different technology in terms of the types of centrifuges and approaches to creating material. But sharing information, yeah, it's certainly possible.
All right, we're going to continue the conversation about North Korea into the second half hour of The Source. Our phone lines are open. If you've got a question or a comment about what North Korea's aims are and what it means for the United States, economically, militarily, diplomatically, give us a call. We want to hear from you. The number is 210-614-8980. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. North Korea, it's also called the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. It's home to about 25 million people, one-fifth the size of Texas, but it is a big pain for people who are trying to make sure that the world stays on course and doesn't break down into a big nuclear warfare, because they've got nukes, and they've got missiles, and they've got chemical warfare, and they've got biological weapons, and they've got a guy in charge, Kim Jong-un, who is a can be kind of unpredictable. So what does that mean for the United States? We're trying to make sure that things don't spin out of control. We're talking about that this afternoon. If you've got questions or comments about North Korea, what do you think, how should the United States proceed with North Korea? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org. Tomorrow, global experts are going to be convening at St. Mary's University to explore these questions on the challenges and opportunities of North Korea. We're joined by Bill Newcomb. He is an economist, and he served on the UN Security Council's panel of experts on North Korean sanctions. Ambassador Tom Hart Armbruster, he is a former ambassador to the Republic of Marshall Islands. And Steve Norper, he is the Korean Society Senior Director and Columbia University Professor. So back to callers. The number is 210-614-8980, and Hugh was on the line. Hugh, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Good afternoon, and hello to the panelists. Quick question. We saw recently where the half-brother was essentially murdered using a VX nerve gas, I believe is what it was. It's odorless, colorless, and tasteless. And is this threat even more dire than perhaps nuclear weapons, given that it's seemingly so easily trafficked? And what's being done? What are the discussions? What can the panelists share with regard to that and preventing that from being used again? These women, we understood in press reports, were asked to perform a prank on someone and ended up being parties to murder, frankly, to the relative of a head of state.
All right.
Thank you, and I'll take my answer off the air, please.
Thank you. So my question is about this act. This is an aggressive act using a banned substance, a chemical weapon, in a foreign soil. It was Malaysia, and it was done. They had to know that this was in an area, a high traffic area where cameras were rolling, that this was going to be visible. Did they think, I mean, we can only speculate, that this was something that was going to be done, you know, covertly and no one would know what happened, or was this an overt act? Bill, go ahead.
David, yeah. You said it exactly right in terms of how egregious it was as an act and what a violation it was. And it certainly has been dramatic and captured our imagination these last 2 weeks. But it is something where it shows the possibility of them to strike. It was meant to be seen very publicly. They employed these two women so that their hands were not directly on it. But there are another 8 North Koreans who are suspect in this case. And so it was meant to send a signal. It was meant to send a signal by Kim Jong-un to others in the North Korean leadership and to refugees, to those who have fled on the outside, that you can be touched. We can reach you. And they did that in a very dramatic fashion. And it's one where, as you indicate, you're talking about a very lethal substance. Not to mention that Malaysia's unhappy because it took place on its soil. And also China's unhappy because Kim Jong-nam lived under Chinese protection in Macau and had a residence in Beijing. And so this is a way that the North Koreans also thumbed the Chinese and said, look, you know what, we can get him when we're ready. But political assassination of this type, very dramatic and very dangerous.
So this happened in Malaysia. Now, there's a connection with North Korea and Malaysia. A lot of the dummy corporations that North Korea has are listed as Malaysian companies. Is that right, Bill? Is that how you reach them? Is that going to upset that apple cart?
I think it's going to make North Korean life in Kuala Lumpur much more difficult. Yes, North Korea has operated some companies out of KL. Most recently, there's been stories about a company that really doesn't exist. It exists as a website and is really operated by a couple of subsidiaries. It's called Glocom. It manufactures battlefield radios. The manufacturing plant happens to be in Pyongyang, but it pretends to be a Malaysian company. And they've had shipments intercepted over the past year. And Malaysia is now taking steps to try and put these operations out of business.
So, Ambassador Ambruster, do you think that Putin looks at Kim and says, what an amateur?
No, I think they're birds of a feather. And as I said, I think they understand each other. I met a couple North Korean diplomats in the Russian Far East. They have a consulate in the town of Nakhodka because they have so many workers there. But I have to say, we didn't get very far in our discussion. Once a year, we would see each other. And every year, I would nod at him, and he would nod at me. And I think one year, we got all the way up to, could you please pass the salt? But, you know, it was very clear that Americans are not to the taste of the North Koreans.
They probably went back and had some meetings about salt. What did he mean by that? Did he mean the strategic treaties? I don't know. So North Korea, the mission of this, my conversation with you guys, is trying to figure out how big of a threat it actually is? Is it just a conventional sort of isolated thing where they make noise? Is it a flashbang that they throw in the middle of the UN Security Council just to distract us and get attention? Or are they really a major concern that could really be a problem, cause misery around the world? So, Stephen, what do you
think? Yeah, the answer is both. So, yes, they're going for the flashbang. They're going for the maximum effect. And they're master propagandists. How can the small state, isolated, keep itself in the headlines the way it has? They're master technicians in that result. But what we have to be concerned about is that the good Korea, as it were, the Korea that's our ally, the Korea that has twice that population, and one can assume the Korea that will manage the Korean Peninsula once some sort of disintegration takes place, that of South Korea. And that's what's endangered here. Our treaty ally with which we share a relationship that was born in blood in the Korean War. Korea now extremely active in the United States, investing all of the results of this CORUS FTA Korea-U.S. Free Trade Agreement. And so the danger to them, the threat to Japan, also a treaty ally, and the fact that these missile and nuclear capabilities put them at risk. And it's just bad behavior all around. What is the thing that we can be doing that we're not doing if we feel this threat? We need to try to get them back to the table, to work with the Russians and the Chinese in such a way that we understand the full nature of the threat. And let me tell you, some Chinese estimates put the nuclear threat at a much higher level than even American analysts do. So it's not just one nation or another. There are pockets of concern in Moscow, in Beijing, in Tokyo, in Seoul, and in Washington about this threat. And it's our duty to try to come up with some sort of creative approach and creative diplomacy. Otherwise, we're going to be dealing with a crisis situation.
But Stephen, when someone has nuclear weapons, you want to make sure that you have a clear line of communication with them at all times in order to clear up, misunderstandings that may lead to, unintentional launchings. So do we have that at least?
Well, we don't. Clearly there are signals that can be sent, but where it becomes especially a matter of concern is that South Korea doesn't even have those. With the downgrade of its relationship with North Korea last year, their hotlines have been turned off. So we can communicate across the DMZ, but what happens in the event of a nuclear accident in North Korea, a mistest, a misfiring, or a stage of one of these enhanced rockets falls onto the territory of Japan? The last one almost hit the Philippines last year, the one that took place in February. And so what happens in the event of mishap or flare-up in tensions? And when you have a hard line from the White House and when you have an extremely hard, dangerous, threatening line from Pyongyang, and you have political consternation, transition in South Korea, it means that you have a recipe for something to go very, very wrong. That's what concerns us all. That's what's brought us to St. Mary's, and that's what's brought us here to your table today.
And Ambassador Armbruster, does Moscow have a direct line to North Korea?
I think that they do. They have a pretty steady stream of diplomats and cultural activities, business. They've been talking about a railway that would link Russia directly with North Korea through that range of the Amur Leopard and a highway as well. So, yes, I think they certainly have influence. And as Steve was saying, this is a test for the United States. And it's not an easy test. It's a very complicated one that's going to involve all sorts of diplomatic and military levers.
But the issue of economic sanctions continues to be a problem when talking about North Korea. That's the first thing they're going to ask is, we'll start talking to you, but first you got to cut us some slack on these sanctions. And so, Bill Newcomb, is that an option?
I don't think so.
Because we're rewarding their bad behavior.
It would be rewarding bad behavior. In the language of the Security Council resolutions, if North Korea were to take certain steps to begin to resolve the issue of the nuclear weapons and the missiles and so forth, some of the sanctions can be suspended. But those aren't the only sanctions out there. There are a lot of autonomous sanctions The U.S. has applied sanctions against North Korea. The EU has applied sanctions against North Korea. Japan has broad sanctions against North Korea. They don't even allow their ships to call there. The ROK has applied sanctions directly against North Korea. So unwinding this, in effect, walking back the cat, would be a very, very challenging task. And yes, they'll ask for it, but I don't think that anyone is going to be giving any kind of grant to the North Koreans where you're going to accept that they're going to do something on spec. They're going to have to come out and demonstrate. It's going to have to be verifiable. And then you might start to see some easing, some kind of rollback.
Okay, one last break. We're talking about North Korea. What kind of threat is it to the United States and to the world? If you got a question or a comment, we'd like you to join our conversation. The number is 210-614-8980, 210-614-8980. You could also email us at thesource@tpr.org. A minute break. We'll be right back. You're listening to Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM, and this is The Source. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about North Korea and its place in the world as a big troublemaker. What does this mean for the United States and for global security, particularly since North Korea has nuclear weapons? They've got biological weapons, chemical weapons, and we've got a leader who's a dictator, and he is he's a very violent kind of guy. The number to call in is 210-614-8980. What is it like to live in North Korea? We've heard about the famines, and we've heard about people starving there. Is that really the case, or was that just the past, and now things have improved? Bill Newcomb?
Well, it was the past. A lot of people died during the famines in the 1990s, both from starvation as well as from rampant disease at that time. Public health services broke down totally. Sanitation broke down. Factories closed. People were on the move looking for food. They were crossing the border to bring stuff back. It was a true disaster.
But the United States came in with food aid, right?
The U.S. came in with food aid as well as others. It had a good effect of pushing nutrition into the country. It had the bad effect of resurrecting the public distribution system, which was one of the relics that was collapsing, was part of the old planned economy. It was one of the ways that the government was able to control the populace.
So was that a mistake to come in with that food aid?
Well, I don't think the food aid itself was a mistake. I think it could have been delivered like it's delivered in other countries through World Food Program. I think it was a mistake to utilize the local distribution system, the public distribution system. But since then, there has been a slow recovery. I have not been in North Korea. I have a lot of friends who have been. So I listen closely when they talk about it. Most of them are in Pyongyang when they visit. And life there has gotten better and better. There are newer buses. There are new fleets of taxis. There are people starting small businesses. There are new apartment blocks being built. And people reportedly are able to buy apartments. In the past, that was not occurring under the old planned socialist-type economy. So that's going on. But in the countryside, life continues to be very, very difficult. There is no mechanization on the farms. There's no electrification on the farms, right? You can envision parts of China where they use pedal wheels to do irrigation. That's North Korea. The people get out in the field and do weeding by hand. It's a very labor-intensive process. They dry grain on the road. So this is a country that, you know, depending on where you look, from where you stand and where you look, it can give a different image to different observers.
So people wonder, how can a country that has people pedal-powered irrigation have nuclear weapons? It's like two different worlds contained in one border.
Because that's what they assign the priority to. It's a policy choice.
Ambassador Armbruster.
We were talking in the break about people-to-people diplomacy and to give North Koreans a view of the world, to get them to travel. And for us, when we have opportunities, when relations are good and when their behavior merits it, I think it's good to have people whether they're businessmen, students, tourists, go, so that North Korea can imagine a different future. Maybe Vietnam is a model, maybe Malaysia, I think they need to think of some other model for a future, because what they have now is not sustainable.
So that model would still be like, you know, in Vietnam, it's a communist country, but mm-hmm. yet they've relaxed a little bit. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. They have a very vibrant trade with their neighbors. They're not seen as a threat to anybody. I think that they're not as isolated, and that's a much healthier future for Vietnam. I think we all want every country to democratize and to be part of the international community, but North Korea is very isolated, and any country that's isolated is dangerous.
But Stephen Norbert, does North Korea see the border with South Korea and think the minute they show any weakness that that border will collapse and that they'll be overrun by the economy and the strength of South Korea?
Well, they do fear that. And even some of the people who support Kim Jong-un, and there has been the emergence of business in North Korea, and by all reports, people support the regime at that level. But that's partially the case, that they're fearful of the way that the South Koreans will integrate. And the border, the demilitarized zone to the south, is one where there's such a heavy outlay of armaments that it's going to take some time to clean up, to demobilize, to demilitarize. And if there's a sudden transition, if there's palace intrigue, the assassination of Kim Jong-un, or some other type of unrest, we could see things spiral out of control very quickly. That is on the spectrum of possibilities. And of course, the other end of the spectrum is that it muddles through in a way where it emerges as something of a Chinese-looking city or mini-state. Perhaps it can begin to liberalize. Vietnam's been mentioned. Myanmar has moved from a very hard position to a softer position. Mongolia is a democratic government that transitioned from a Stalinist economy. All have elements, but North Koreans don't want to talk about reform, the regime that is. And the reason they don't want to do that is because they're afraid of the splinter, and they're afraid of losing the solidity of the regime. It's all about regime survival. So will information flows, new information, will these new market activities in North Korea, will the rise of a young North Korean population mean rising expectations and create a challenge to the leader, Kim Jong-un? And is that something that we can help through people-to-people exchanges and by opening universities and opening opportunities for them to learn business or other skills outside?
All right, let me go to the phones. Michael has called in. Michael, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I appreciate it. I was just wondering if the host, if they could address thinking from the perspective of the North Koreans. For them, I don't live in North Korea, but I assume that they're aware that other countries in the world have nuclear weapons. So as an American, to perceive North Korea as a potential threat or as a threat with nuclear weapons, how would you say from their perspective, if they perceive other countries in the world with nuclear weapons, they perceive those countries as a threat? And secondly, why is it okay for a certain number of countries to have nuclear weapons, but other ones, you know, they're perceived as a threat, or it's not okay for them to have nuclear weapons? Thank you.
Michael, thank you for the call. Bill Newcomb, I know you're an economist, not a nuke guy, but maybe you can help us here.
Well, international policy is trying to prevent proliferation of nuclear weapons. North Korea is not recognized by anyone except itself as being a nuclear-capable state. North Korea withdrew from the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and the whole object is to get them back in and get control of this fissionable material. So anyone who has it, is North Korea going to be a direct threat? Or are there nukes meant to just be able to have a deterrent effect on anyone who wants to invade them? I mean, you can argue that both ways. But the other North Korea threat is the proliferation threat. And it proliferated to Syria. It proliferated to Libya. And who's to say who it might proliferate to in the next
Iran.
Time? Or terrorist groups.
Is the goal for the United States eventually to try to get nuclear weapons out of the hands of North Korea? Is that really what we should be aspiring for?
Stephen?
Sure. That is the stated U.S. goal, both of the Obama administration and to this point the Trump administration, that denuclearization is what the United States wants to see to get North Korea to that negotiating table. Where we have to be flexible, though, is, are there other places where we can start to get them to the table to realize the ends that we desire? And clearly there are many other issues in terms of development and enhancing stability on the peninsula that can come into play. So we should probably take a wider perspective, but that's my scholarly recommendation. And those in positions of power clearly have been trying to push for denuclearization as the way to get to the table.
And Ambassador Embrooster, what about reunification?
Well, I think it's good to start looking at the future. And one of the great things about the St. Mary's Conference is it allows folks like these experts to talk about what are the possibilities and to have conflict resolution experts think about a post-divided Korea. And so I really congratulate St. Mary's on doing this. I know they've got a very good international program. I get emails from students from time to time that I've worked with. And so I think for people who are excited by this conversation, have a look at careers.state.gov because there is a lot of work to do in international diplomacy, and I think this particular problem is not going to go away for a long time.
And Bill Newcomb, as you look at what's your take? Where are we going with North Korea? How do you feel about it right now?
Oh, I'm very concerned. I'm concerned because we have not been able to define the proper policy to get them to start reining in on their programs. I'm concerned because the administrations in various capitals pay attention to North Korea sporadically. It has never been a firm policy objective day one, day two, day three. So every time they act up, they get some attention, and then the can gets kicked down the road. It's time we made it a vital objective.
It does seem like whenever there's something else happening around the world, that North Korea will do something to say, hey, remember me, I'm over here, don't forget about me. So you're saying if we had a consistent approach, treat North Korea the way they see themselves as a nuclear power, then maybe they would be less likely to be so volatile.
No, not okay. Quite. Not as they see themselves as a nuclear power, but to see the North Korea problem as one that we need to solve. And we have different issues that foreign policy handles from time to time, and they cycle. So in 2015, the whole U.S. government focus was Iran.
Right.
They didn't pay any attention to North Korea until 2016.
And now we got to do it today.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, our guests. We appreciate it. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.